From being the only black player in the side, I remember being fairly young. I was 14 and I was going for trials for the England youth team, and my coach was a black coach at the time. And he was one person. I was very naive at that age, and he was like, "I don't know if you know, but you're going to be the only black player on that camp." And he goes, "You're going to have to work hard, if not harder than everybody else, to get into that team." He goes, you've got to stand out. You've got to stand out to get into that England side. And it's something that stuck with me, and something that's driven me, that I have to work harder and I have to be better than everybody else around me.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are joined by Huddersfield Giants loose forward, Michael Lawrence. Michael, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on. I first sort of bumped into you on LinkedIn because I know that you've been doing a degree course at Carnegie. So I'd be interested to know what you're going to do with that, because you've also just been brought onto the inclusivity board, haven't you? The inclusion board at rugby for the rugby league. So welcome to the show. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Thanks for having me here, guys. I'm Michael Lawrence. I'm 30 years old. I'm a professional rugby player for the Huddersfield Giants. I've been at the club for 14 years now. Pretty much played all my professional rugby league up from my hometown club. Away from the field, I'm currently in the final year of my sports coaching degree. I've also been made a board member of the RFL's Inclusion and Diversity Board.
Michael, how did you get started in rugby? What was it that made you so attracted to it?
It's a funny story, really. I first started playing rugby as a six-year-old. I live with my mum in a place called Thornhill. And I had no idea what the sport was, but our back garden backed onto Thornhill rugby fields, basically. And a team were out there training, and mum just dragged me across and asked if I could join in. And yeah, that was it, really. I literally fell in love with the sport. The main thing was, as a 5-6-year-old, I loved that I could get dirty and not get in trouble, really. That was the main attraction at that age. But no, I absolutely loved the sport. We moved to Huddersfield then after about 6 months of playing there, and the local club at the time. The first thing I wanted to do when I moved to Huddersfield was find the local rugby club, and that was Newham Panthers at the time. And
right.
From there, from a 7-year-old all the way up till 16 when I signed professional for Huddersfield. So yeah, all played pretty much all my junior rugby at Newham Panthers in Huddersfield.
And you obviously have this role on the rugby league board, the inclusion board. How inclusive did you find the sport back then as you were growing up? Because there were a few black rugby players, weren't there, at the time, but probably not that many. It's very predominantly a white northern sport, isn't it? So I just wondered, how inclusive did you find it then?
Yeah, as I say, I found it inclusive as the club was very welcoming to me. I was the only black player. I wouldn't say it was very diverse at the time. There wasn't a lot of black players playing. Obviously, I was the only one in my team, and there were probably a few others dotted around the league. The reasons for the inclusive, for lack of diversity, probably was that there wasn't many other black players playing in the league. So obviously, when you see more people from the same areas of you that look like you playing the sport, it's more attractive to you, to be honest. But as far as inclusive and welcoming, I felt very welcome at Newsom. But yeah, no, from the diversity sense, that's something obviously that we're trying to grow.
And what role do they want you to play then at the rugby league on this inclusion board, Michael? What is it that they are asking you to do?
They see me as obviously a crucial part of it, because obviously I'm the only player on there. So I'm the only guy that's involved in the sport as a professional level. So on the board, there's people from all walks of life. So from business, from teaching, from schools, from all different areas. But I'm the only actual person on there that's currently involved in rugby league at a professional level. So they see me as the link between the players and what's going on in the game and the board, and I can try and reflect that back and bridge the gap. From an actual work perspective, I'm more of an advisory role, really. So we meet once every quarter. Underneath us, there's 12 of us on the board. Underneath us, there's a working team that will be going out into these communities, into these schools, into these different community clubs, and delivering the program, trying to encourage the diversity and increase rugby league in these different areas that we're trying to target.
And that's awesome, Michael. And I think what's really quite reflective thinking about that is there's these parallel worlds where sport kind of reflects business quite a lot, and sport massively influences business. And some companies are thinking about maybe having more of their workforce on boards. And here you are in rugby already having a player on the board, which is a very progressive thing to do. So just from that point of view, you've been the first player on the board. How's that experience working?
Yeah, it's been very good, to be fair. I feel in a very privileged position and a very important position, obviously, to voice the thoughts of the players and the rest of the league. There's the whole wide range of different people, and it's good to hear everybody's thoughts and different viewpoints on the situation. I think that's why they did it. I don't think they just wanted a group of players. I think they wanted thoughts from all different walks of life because, as I say, inclusivity and diversity is it covers every single area of work, really, and it's good to get them different points of view.
That, though, is amazing, because that, what you've just explained, is an inclusive board where they've not just looked for the most senior people in the organisation or the shareholders or the people with the financial responsibility. They've actually gone and said, we don't have a player on the board, or, you know, who else do we need on the board? Definitely. And I think business could learn a lot from that. You know, you think about boards in business, they're often so similar in their way of thinking.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. I think they should be pretty much, yeah, everything. I think the more different trains of thought you've got, the better judge of a situation you'll have, really, if you've got people from different backgrounds, different work areas, or I think it works really well.
Thinking back to your you know, rugby career and growing up in Huddersfield, and it is unique that, you know, you've stayed at the same club for so long, but what was that moment where you first kind of thought, inspired by somebody that just really demonstrated inclusivity or really went against the grain and did something really inspiring, and you were like, I want to be a leader. I want to be like that.
My first captain was the most inspirational person for me, as a guy called Brett Hodgson. When I first signed at the club as a 16-year-old, he was the club captain at the time, and he just had an aura about him. He just had an aura about him that every time he spoke, everybody literally listened and gripped off every word, pretty much. And yeah, you could tell he just had the respect of his peers and his staff and everywhere around him. And I just knew I wanted to be like that one day. I wanted to follow in those footsteps and be a professional the way he was a professional. I think it was just the way he carried himself and spoke to people, communicated. He didn't have to scream and bawl to get his point across, but everybody respected what he said, and he knew when he said it in a calm way that it made you want to be better. It made you want to bring the best out of yourself. And I think there's only certain people that can do that. Obviously, being a pro for 14 years now, I've gone through six coaches and a lot of captains, and played with a lot of players in my times. I've played in international teams, in England internationals, in Jamaican internationals, and yeah, there's only very few players that have that aura and that sense of that sense of that real natural leadership ability about them.
Yeah.
You tend to think it is just that natural leadership ability, Michael. It's not something that they've learned on a program or a course or maybe something they've copied from somebody else.
I think it's a collection of a few things. I think some of it's natural, natural personality. So just the natural way of being. I think some of it can be worked on, definitely. I think a lot over my career, I've worked a lot on my leadership skills and areas to get better and improve as a leader. And I think, as you said, the third part is people that were leaders when you're younger. younger person in the team, people that you've looked up to. I think you can take parts of different people, different coaches, the good parts, the bad parts you can learn from, and then you can put that into yourself and use that as you go forward, definitely.
Yeah, I wonder on that though, Michael. I do think you can teach a lot of these things, and that's what we're in the business of. I just don't think you can teach somebody who doesn't have that drive to do it or that desire. And there's obviously something in you that's gone, I want more of that. And you've got a natural curiosity for it.
100% agree. Yeah, you've got to want to be a leader. You can't become a leader. We've got a person in our team, probably our most decorated player, who's Jermaine McGilvery. He's played for England numerous amount of times. And the amount of times that the head coaches have tried to bring him into the leadership group, but he just wants none of it. He doesn't want to be a leader. He's our star player. And everybody looks up into him in the team for his ability and what he can do. But in regards to other people and communicating and bringing them on, it's just not in his personality to be that way, I think.
Again, though, I'm drawing so many parallels with business, where I think this is where sport excels. Yeah. Is that you all recognise that. He knows his place. He knows what he's great at. And he's happy to just be that star player. Yeah. In business, he would be promoted. The only way he would be able to get more money is to get promoted and to lead people. And actually, there's nothing wrong with saying, well, the person that wants to lead can lead, and the person that wants to be decorated. And I think that's really interesting, that dynamic. Yeah. And I'm sure you and him almost play off each other on that, and that helps the team's cohesiveness.
100%, yeah. It does help, and we do bounce off each other. We've known each other for a long time. From the business point of view, that is very interesting, to be fair, because I suppose the people do want to be promoted, and obviously for the financial benefits, and I suppose sometimes they can be forced into that, and then they're not the best leaders, but obviously they do want the financial benefits. So yeah, I understand it's a bit of a catch-22 from that point of view. Yeah, definitely. I never thought about that, but yeah, I can see how that happens.
Yeah, because he must love doing what he does as being the star man in the team. I think that does happen quite a lot when people stop it. They end up not doing the job that they really wanted to do, simply because it's almost like expected that they're the next one up for the next job. Interesting stuff.
Pretty much exactly the same as that, yeah, because he'd played for England so many times, they just expected that he'd want to be a leader, but yeah, it's just not part of him. And he's let people know now, to be fair. So I think the coaches have finally got the point.
It's interesting, Michael, in terms of what would he want to do then by comparison to maybe you in a future career? I mean, how long is a rugby career if you can stay fairly injury-free?
If you stay injury-free, you're looking mid-30s, 35 if you're lucky.
Right.
You're lucky, definitely. Once you hit 30, you're at the back end of your career pretty much. You're counting down from then.
So what's next for you then? Where's your head going?
So for me, obviously I want to graduate at university, obviously whilst I'm still playing, I feel like I've still got a few more good years of rugby league left in me yet. But alongside that, I'll be doing my training in my teacher training, PGCE, in physical education. So that's what I'm hoping to have the qualifications for. So when I do decide to hang up the boots and retire, I'll be a qualified teacher and I can apply for teaching jobs. That's something I really think I'll excel in. And it's a career path I'm looking to go down once rugby league's done.
Is that what you always had in mind then, Michael? Because, I mean, it is a short career, isn't it? So this level. Is that something you had in mind in terms of planning your career out?
Pretty much that. A lot of people take it for granted, and they don't take the opportunities of education that we get. We get courses and degrees and stuff offered to us all the time. And it took me till 27. I had a serious knee injury that season, and I missed about 5 months of rugby. I think I only played 5 games that year. And it took that for me to realise that rugby league can be gone at any moment. And that's when I decided to start my degree, pretty much. So, and start planning for after rugby, really. Some players I'd advise younger players to do it as early as possible, and do as much education away from the field as possible, because I feel the more prepared you are for retirement, the better you'll cope with it. Because I know there's a lot of players that have retired and do retire that really do struggle with that transition.
On that though, Michael, I mean, it's an interesting dynamic, that, isn't it? Because we only tend to take stock and learn when we make a mistake, or in your case, have an injury. But do you know what I mean? Something doesn't go our way. And we all have so much advice for our younger selves, and we wish the younger players would listen. But what is it that you could do, and how can you get that message through to them, do you think? That
I don't know, to be fair, because it was the same when I was 18. The older boys would be telling me it goes quick. It really does go quick. Your career goes quick. Or you find all the 30-year-old players in the team saying that, and it really does. Before you know it, seems like 2 minutes ago I was making my debut, and yeah, like now I'm in my 14th season. And it's just gone like that. So yeah, I suppose you've just got to continue to advise. There's player welfare managers at every team now, which weren't around when I was a youngster, and they're constantly on the young players' backs, trying to get them into education, onto some kind of course away from rugby, because most days we're done training for 1 o'clock, and that's it. The young boys will go home and they'll sit on the Xbox or watch TV or whatever else, and there's a lot of time where you can be doing productive stuff for after your career, really, and getting qualified in whatever area you feel like. And yeah, I just feel like I'd just say make use of your time, really. Make use of your time and put it to something productive rather than just sitting on your bum and chilling out.
Yeah. I wonder, how difficult is it not to get drawn into doing stuff that really isn't productive? You know, if you're not particularly academic and you don't really have that sort of persuasion, it must be very easy to be able to sit around doing the wrong things when you've got that much time on your hands.
100%, yeah, definitely. If you haven't got that drive and that get up and go, then yeah, it's easy. It's easy to just be, yeah, as you say, just sat at home eating, I don't know, going to the pubs when it's warm and stuff like that. Pretty much it can be very easy. So yeah, that's that discipline. And I suppose that's what separates the mediocre athletes from the best. You've got to have that discipline, to be fair. To be a professional at training and when you're away from training as well, that's what it takes. You've got to be professional for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
That's an interesting point, because I always think of professional athletes, and even if you're semi-professional, as extremely driven people and motivated people. But to think actually there's motivation within motivation, yeah. and you have to be driven to a different degree to really excel. And I suppose you see that amplified, like you must see the most extreme cases of that, where there's people with immense talent that only go so far, and there's the people that really try that can surpass them. What are your biggest tips for staying motivated? What's managed to keep you this motivated?
Constant goal setting, for me, to be honest. Constant goal setting, the fear of failure, just constant pressure. There's pressure. The one thing with professional sport is there's pressure, and you're only as good as your next game or your last performance. There's constantly, somebody's constantly trying to take your place. You're constantly playing for a new contract. A younger player's constantly trying to take your place in the team. And as you get older, you get more responsibility. So you have a house to pay for, you have family to provide for, all that stuff plays a part. So yeah, there's a lot of pressure with professional sport, and that's what keeps me personally. That's what keeps me driven, pretty much. To it's what keeps me focused and wanting to succeed and be the best possible athlete I can be every day, really.
Where does that drive come from for you? You know, do you think it comes from your parents? I don't know what your upbringing was like. Do you think it comes from being the only black lad on the team initially, and perhaps that fear of failure was bigger for you? Or do you think it's just something innate or something else?
A bit of everything, to be honest. My upbringing, my parents were both very, very hardworking, especially my dad. And that was something that was driven into me from a young age. And the type of player I am, I'm not the superstar player. My game's based off hard work and honesty and consistency. And that's what's given me a long career. I remember one of my first coaches saying, if you're consistent and you're constantly an 8, 7 out of 10 every single week, you will play and you'll have a long career. It's when your game's up and down. That's when people will get rid of you and you won't be in the team. And from being the only black player in the side, I remember being fairly young. I was 14 and I was going for trials for the England youth team. And my coach was a black coach at the time. And he was one person. I was very naive at that age. And he was like, I don't know if you know, but you're going to be the only black player on that camp. And he goes, you're going to have to work hard, if not harder than everybody else, to get into that team. He goes, you've got to stand out. You've got to stand out to get into that England side. And it's something that stuck with me and something that's driven me that I have to work harder and I have to be better than everybody else around me, pretty much. And yeah, those things, think when you get told stuff like that when you're really young from someone who was really respected, he was a professional player in the game at the time, it sticks with you.
How do you feel about that now? Because at the time, of course, back then, that's something that somebody would say to you and you would believe. But how do you feel like about that now? And what would you say to your younger self?
I suppose he was probably putting his experiences onto me. So obviously when he grew up and he was in that team, it'd have been 80s probably, and it would probably have been more relevant then. Now, probably not as relevant, but from the sense of hard work and having to be better than everybody else around you, I'd still push that message, because it's got me to where I am. Obviously, anytime you're in a team situation or in a training situation, you want to be the best player. You want to be pushing the best scores, training the best to make sure that you're in the team. And it's something, that drive, that fight, that want to the best is something you've always got to have, because I feel when you lose that, you might as well just hang up the boots at that point.
Yeah, I think just reflecting on that, I mean, it's a bit music to John's ears, because he's a values-driven coach. But when you were talking about what motivated you, I just really got this sense of you were really, even from a young age, a very values-driven player, and that you played a game based on your values, and that's how you wanted to always operate. And that's perhaps what's made you be consistent, yeah, rather than just being consistent per se.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a very proud person. Proud of my performance and the way I'm on the field. And yeah, definitely. My core values of hard work and commitment and being honest on the field is something that I live by, and that anything I do on or off the field, to be honest.
I'm interested in thinking what understanding what you think about this then, Michael, because in business, a lot of people who can become very perfectionist, if you like, and they can go to the nth degree in order to be as successful as they can, and doesn't always help in business. Interestingly though, in sport, it's absolutely everything, isn't it? It's constantly like honing your skills and your ability. I wonder how long can you keep doing that? Just that daily grind, because it must get harder and harder as we get older.
Yeah, it does, to be fair. And when it gets too hard, that's probably when you have to retire, to be honest. And there's some young 20, 21-year-old that's taking your spot. But no, that's it. It never stops. Professional sport, coaches, teams, players, you're chasing perfection. But perfection doesn't exist, but we'll constantly chase it every single year, every single season, every game. That's, you're chasing the perfect game. But as I said, it never exists, but that's what you strive to do.
And when you said that earlier on, you were talking about one of the things that really motivated you was to setting goals. How many goals do you set? Do you set lots and lots of them? And do you keep changing those so that it sort of keeps you fresh?
Constantly set weekly goals, monthly goals, yearly goals. You've just got a constant targets, constant things to keep driving you. Physical goals, statistical goals, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, and it just keeps you going. It keeps you going. It keeps you striving. It keeps trying to get better every single week.
And how much of that is down to you as an individual then, Michael, or is it very much driven from a team coaching point, a team management?
The most of it is individual. There's obviously team goals, but a lot of that's just my personal way of functioning. I know a lot of players do loads of different stuff, some stuff that's really, really out there, some stuff that is similar to what I do. But yeah, every player, and I've found that each individual has different motivations for why they play the sport. You've just got to try tap into that and find out a person's why. I think that's very important as a leader, as a coach, finding out somebody's reason why do you do what you do. And I think once you know that, you can get the best out of somebody.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you all share that as a team? Like, is that something that you're encouraged to do, or is that something that you just personally believe in and you live by?
It's something that's come in over the past couple of years, but it's something that I personally believe in. As I've grown older and obviously been in the sport a long time, it's something that I've seen and I've seen works. Something that I've noticed that everybody doesn't get motivated by the same thing. So no. Someone can say, oh, we're going to win today because we're playing for the coach. Some players will be like, yes, we are. Other people will be like, I'm not bothered about the coach. I couldn't care less. Some people play for family. Some people play for money. Some people play because they want to play international games. Some people love the club. Others couldn't care less about the club. Everybody's got a different reason why they play a professional sport and why they want to be successful. And it's important to find out somebody's why.
So you have just described any team that any leader that's listening to this will be experiencing. You know, you've got a group of players that all have totally different whys that need to be working together. And I think this is where we see the amplification of teamwork in sport, because, you know, you're a member of numerous teams, but let's talk about Huddersfield for now. What age and how has your relationship changed between being a player and being much more aware of everybody else on the field? You know, as I imagine when you first start out, you're very much about you.
Yeah.
I've got a 7-year-old nephew who plays football, and all he's bothered about is how many goals he scores. Yeah. We've had to start bribing him with stickers to get for assists, you know, like we're like, no, if you set them up, you'll get rewarded more. Yeah. But that's a growth journey, isn't it? Where you start to go. But talk us through the dynamics of the team and how much you focus on each other in the team, you as the captain and what your role is versus your team. Just talk us through your leadership approach in all of that.
It's kind of developed over my career. So obviously I came into the team as a 17-year-old, and obviously bottom end of the scale when I was coming in. I was the leaders in the team at that time, really good leaders. The first 8 years of my career, we was very successful. We won the League Leaders' Shield. We was in Challenge Cup final. We was in the playoffs every single season up until 2015, when I was 25. That season, we had a big turnover of players. So we lost probably 10 senior players out of us, 20-25 man squad. And as a 25-year-old, I was just thrusted into being a senior player in the space of a couple of months. And then, boom, straight in at the deep end. And we've kind of gone in since then into a period of transition, really, because the squad age really reduced, the average age of the squad. And I was put into the leadership group at that time. One of my good mates, Leroy Cudjoe, was made club captain. He's a few years older than me. And it was at that point, really, probably mid-career, 25, when I started to think about leadership and how can I be a better leader. And everybody at the club was telling me that people are looking up to me now because I was one of the senior members of the team. And it was at that point when I started to try to develop these skills. And I think it's just through experience and learning and reading numerous books that I've tried to pick areas to improve that area in myself and that skill and that quality, really. And then probably 2018, Leroy had a big injury, and I was the vice captain at the time, and that's when I became I was vice captain, so I was kind of like standing captain for 2 years pretty much whilst he was injured.
Yeah. I'm just thinking, like, when you were saying, so you've moved into leadership and you're talking about setting goals, how many of those goals are focused on you and your targets? And yeah. And do you have any goals that are like about the team? So how you all communicate together, or I need to work on my relationship with this person because it's not that strong, yeah. Or this person's more motivated by money, I'm not, I don't know whether you are or not, but we've got a value conflict there, or do you know what I mean? How much consideration do you give to that side of being a captain?
That's everything. At the start of the season, that was one of my main goals, to get to know my players even better. We had a lot of new players. We had 8 new players this year. So that was one of our goals. A lot of the guys that have been there for a long time, I know how they work. I know on the field, some people can take a bit of a spraying to rile them up and get a reaction from, and they'll play better. Some players, you need to put an arm around them and boost them up, and you'll get the best out of them that way. So, yeah, getting to know people's personalities, getting to know people on a deeper level. I feel if you get to know people on a deeper level, you have that bond and that connection. And when you are under the fire and you're on the field, it really shows through when you've got that real mateship with people around you, when it's not just more than face value in a professional manner, should I say.
Yeah, on the money, yeah.
How does it make you feel being that leader, Michael? How does it feel to be that role? And who chooses? How do you actually get selected as captain? Does it come from the group, the actual team? Do they?
So the coach chooses the captain. So the head coach and the staff, and the team select the leadership group. So you vote for who you think should be in the leadership group, and that's made up of probably 4 or 5 more players that are in a leadership group. So you've got the club cap, you've got a coach, club captain, leadership group, and then the players underneath that.
And has that been the case with all the coaches that you've had? Have they all done that?
Yeah, some coaches have done different things. Some coaches have just selected a leadership group off their own back, and sometimes that's not gone down too well. Mainly because they select favourites, people they get on with, people they like. So sometimes that can affect the dynamics of the group. I think obviously the democratic way of having a vote, and each player has their say on who they want within that group, has worked well. But as I say, there's pluses and negatives to both ways of doing it. But the way we've done it is the way we've decided to do it. Whereas the coach selects the captain. I mean, obviously, the leadership group can still have a strong input on what happens around the club.
That sounds like a pretty inclusive approach. I mean, there's always room for improvement. But what do you do, if anything, as a team and a collective to check your biases regularly? Because this is the thing. We all have people that we prefer. And naturally, we all have preferences, right? So you're going to have your favourites. But in sport, when you need to be putting your best team forward, what do you all do regularly to check those biases?
It's a tough one for myself personally. I make a conscious effort to speak to everyone and try not to favour the people and speak to the people that I'm most comfortable with, that I've known the longest. So I make a conscious effort to make sure I'm mingling with everybody around the club and speaking to everyone equally, pretty much. But no, yeah, it is a very tough one to try not to have those supposed cliques within a group. When it's a big group, it can happen, and people naturally gravitate towards who they're comfortable around. But it's a tough one for me. Like as I said, I just try to make sure I spread my time as best as possible. But yeah, that's the only way I try to address that one, really.
Yeah, that is a good it's a good way to be aware of it. I'm just reflecting on some of the best leaders that, you know, I would kind of view of people who I found inspirational. And I do wonder, I don't know if there's any evidence for this, but I do wonder if it's people that have sometimes felt like the outsider growing up are the ones that make the most effort to consciously include others when they are growing up. And I'm just reflecting on a really inspirational leader I had, and he was adopted. Yep. As a child, and when he shared that, it was like, oh my goodness, I just totally get you, because he was the CEO, and the first person he would speak to in any room was the most junior person. Yeah. Just to make them feel, it was such a wonderful gift to have and skill to have. And I do wonder if that's just a natural byproduct of having a feeling like an outsider growing up.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree. I suppose it could be. Yeah, because obviously, as you said, feeling like an outsider, unless you've experienced that feeling or gone through that, you can't relate to it. That's one thing I think is massive. I think empathy is massive for leadership. I think understanding people's situations, the way they feel, how they're going to react to certain things. I think that's another massive part of being a good leader, having that side to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
you've got a lot of self-awareness, Michael, and I think that's the starting point, isn't it? It's that curiosity and being aware of how you come across to other people, and that everybody's different and you can learn from people who are different.
Definitely.
I guess that's from a rugby point of view, is there still stuff that you're learning that's new, or do you think it's more about the sort of the man management styles that you might want to use?
For as in playing or leaderships, like as in leadership side?
Yeah, as in playing versus leadership, yeah.
I'd say from a rugby point of view, yeah, it's the man management stuff for me, to be honest. The game, obviously I've been playing the game for pretty much nearly 20 years now, so... Yeah, I know the game. It's people. It's dealing with people, really. Anytime you're in a team, you're dealing with people and understanding people, understanding the personalities, understanding what makes them tick, the why, how they work. I think that part will decide whether you're a good leader or not.
Let's talk about the playing different games and different roles, because anybody in a leadership role operates at one level where perhaps they're the leader and they've got their team, but then there's always the game up where you're with the stakeholders or shareholders and you're the different. Now for you, that's Huddersfield versus when you're playing for Jamaica.
Yeah.
Talk us through, how do you balance that? How do you change your mindset? How do you change your approach when you don't have the benefit of time to really get to know people and apply all those tried and tested commitment things?
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yeah, so luckily in the Jamaica side, I kind of went into that team with a lot of social capital, really. I was one of the most senior players in the side, and I played the most Super League games. So I played over 300 Super League games now. And in the team, there was only three other Super League players at the time. The rest of the players were part-time players. So I was lucky enough to go into that group as a respected player and one of the senior members of the team. So obviously getting to know my players in a short space of time was tough, and it is hard. And I kind of wasn't as, not aggressive, but wasn't as far forward with my leadership stuff that week, because we was only together for a week. Once I'm on the pitch, I totally change, and I'm shouting and bawling at everyone because I'm in the game then, and it's just me, it's just the way I am. But obviously away from the pitch, I wasn't super quiet. Anytime I was in training, I'd be talking, but obviously away from the field, I didn't really know the guys that much. So I was just trying to get to know people slowly. They were trying to get to know me. And by the end of the week, I think I did have a really good impact on the group, because obviously they voted me into the leadership group by the end of the week for the next year. They put me into their like team WhatsApp group as well. So I must have had a good knock-on effect with the players there. And I'm really close to them now. Obviously, we had no games last year because of the pandemic, but we speak on pretty much a daily basis. And although I've not seen the guys in person for a long, long time, I do feel like that bond and those friendships have really grown over the past year.
That's an interesting observation, Michael, that once you cross over the white line, it's, this is how I'm going to behave.
Yeah.
And so that's, do people that who are playing with your teammates, they appreciate that is the difference? Once you cross the white line, when you're playing the game, you behave in a certain way. Yeah. But actually, when I'm talking to this guy, off the pitch or what have you, it's quite a different approach.
100%. Once you're on the field, it's all about winning. It's all about result. It's all about there and then and winning that game and doing whatever it takes to win that game. Professional sports are results-based business. If you lose, you lose your job, you lose your contract, you lose your livelihood. It's about winning at the end of the day. And I'm going to do and tell you whatever I say and whatever I think to get the best out of that team on that pitch at that moment, out of that individual. Obviously, once we're off the field, we'd address it in a different manner and I'd speak in a different manner, but on the field we're competing, we're there to win, and yeah, that's pretty much all my focus is. And I suppose as long as everybody else knows that and knows that's what I'm about, it works, and it works well. And I think a lot of people in sport, most people, the majority of people I've met, they're all there to win. Nobody's there to lose, nobody wants to lose. And I think if your teammates know you want what's best for the team and you want to be successful and you want to win, they can take that feedback on the field when you're giving them, maybe not in the most kindest manner, but in the manner that's going to be the most effective.
Yeah. I think this is where in sport the boundaries are much clearly drawn to, like, our favourite book, Simon Sinek's Infinite Game, where you are absolutely in a finite environment when you're on the pitch and it is everything to win. But when you're off the pitch, you're more aware that you're in an infinite game where you've all got different desires and you're never going to win at life because nobody does, but you want to grow and be the best you can. But then very quick, you're thrown back into a finite game. Whereas I think in business, the thing that we all have to be careful of, and me more than anybody, is that we sometimes approach it with the finite mindset. Where nobody can win at business, nobody can win at life, nobody wins at relationships. And at work, we are all just in these multiple relationships.
How much of it is an auto response then on the field, Michael? Or do you have to work at how you communicate on the field, even when you're off the field thinking about it? Or is it just a very much like an auto response, and it's there aren't that many variations really on it. It's just how I actually behave.
Yeah, that's where the natural part comes in for me. Yeah. It's just something I've always done, pretty much from since I can remember, from being a kid. As soon as I'm on the field, I'm talking, I'm telling people what to do, I'm telling people around me what we need to do, what needs to be done better. And then you've got some players that are silent, and prefer to lead with actions. I think that's where the natural leadership skills come through when you're actually on the field. I think the more important leadership skills come off the field, though, to be honest. I think that's the stuff where people really, really take notice of what you do and the way you carry yourself around the environment. I think it's big, it's huge for team culture.
Well, I think when you're off the field, you obviously get the time, don't you? You have the opportunity to ask questions. I should imagine when you're on the field, it's pretty much do it instruction. You it's all about commands.
100%. That's it at the time. On the field, it's do this, do that. This is what we need to do now, pretty much. And then when you're off the field, you've got a discussion. You can actually come back and question reasons. You can question things. You can work on ways to do stuff better. Whereas on the field, it's this is what's happening, this is what we've got to do.
So on that off the field, your life has, you know, changed quite a lot in the last 2-3 years, you know, family and leadership roles becoming a bit different. And then obviously things like Black Lives Matter have happened and companies have woken up to the need, Britain's woken up to the need to be more inclusive, to be more aware of the biases. And you've moved into these roles where you are on inclusion boards and you're almost creating and carving out a new career for yourself on that. How does that feel, number one, to have happened to you? And where's your head at the minute?
Yeah, so it's been a bit of a whirlwind, to be honest. Obviously, what happened last year to George Floyd was terrible. And coming back in July last year after the pandemic hit, Sky wanted to, we knew as a rugby league, we wanted to show our support, and I did a big interview with Sky and around the matter and shared some of my personal thoughts and experiences of being involved in rugby league and racism growing up. And there was a lot of backlash off the back of that. And that's kind of what set everything in motion, really. And it was off that back of the backlash that I knew some work needed to be done, to be honest. And off the back of that, the Tackle It plan was formed. And at first, obviously, I'm the type of person that I like to see something through that I start. And when the offer came to be on the board, I took it with both hands because I thought it was a real opportunity to create some positive change within the game and have an impact, really. So, and yeah, it's just everything just kind of flowed onto the other off the back of that interview. Before that interview, if you'd have said I'd be in the position I'm in now, doing things I'm doing now, I wouldn't have thought it had got to this point. But no, I'm really glad it has, and I'm really confident of having a positive impact on the situation.
Knowing now that you are a goal-setting individual, I'm sure you've set yourself some goals around your inclusivity work.
Yeah.
Where do you see yourself going with it in the next year, and where would you like to be as you're coming into kind of your rugby retirement with it? Do you think this could be something that you'd like to pursue?
So obviously, as a board member, you're on the board for 2 years before you can be re-elected. And the Tackle It plan's in place for 5 years. All the targets are measurable, obviously, by the numbers. The plan's actually on the IFL website, so if you want to have a look over that at some stage, feel free. But yeah, it's just about increasing the numbers pretty much within the game, and that's how it'll be measured. And they're the steps we're looking to take, and we're just constantly trying to push that to increase diversity within the game.
Yeah, so I'll ask you the million-dollar question that you probably get asked all the time. Do you think that the numbers and the metrics, do you think it's the best idea for the solution? I mean, you have to measure, otherwise you don't know it moves.
Yep.
But do you think that's the best approach to focus on, or do you think there's other things that need to go hand in hand?
I think there's other things to go hand in hand, but I think that's the way that we'll get diversity at all levels of the game. So we want diversity in the boardrooms,
right?
In coaches, players, community game players, and I think that's where it starts. I think if you get more numbers in the community game, these people will stay in the game and they'll filter up, and hopefully that way we'll get diversity across the board. I think that's the way to do it, because one thing of all that I've done, so many interviews and things like that, black people and people of color, they don't want a handout in these positions. Some people have suggested that you should just make it so that you have to be there. You want to be qualified, you want to be good enough to do the role. And I think everybody wants to make sure that every spot that's given is earned, definitely.
Yeah, I think that would be the same though for rugby, is more associated with more well-off backgrounds. So I think it's just the same that people from poorer communities need to see that they're represented, and it needs to start at a grassroots level. So I couldn't agree more that you need to see it at that grassroots level.
100%. Yeah, I think that's where it starts, and I think from there it'll filter up.
Yeah.
What are some of those challenges in getting people to be interested in the sport then? Because there's a lot of resistance perhaps around being involved in rugby because of sort of head injuries and stuff, and we've seen it with the football that they're trying to do something with it there. Do you think that parents and carers and guardians are worried about that as being a specific problem?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's the fear of head injuries. But on the whole, rugby league is a very, very safe sport if coached well from a young age, to be fair. But yeah, you're always going to have people that are concerned. I think in the areas where rugby league's played, and you've got players that have played it and they've got brothers and sisters that have played the game, I think those type of people just fall into the sport and are brought up with it. It's the people that don't necessarily play and that are involved in the game, they're the people we're looking to attract to the game. And I think the only way to do that, I think it starts in the schools, to be honest. I think that's where it can introduce the game at a certain level, and if you've got that enjoyment, then hopefully they'll go along to their local amateur club and start playing the game there. But I think the schools is a place where it's got to start.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's with the schools, it's an opportunity to finding something that you're good at and that you excel at that you may not have opportunity to kind of experience before. And the same could be said for business stuff. You know, I think they should probably do a bit more of that in schools.
We ask each of our guests to give us three leadership essentials that they'd like to actually share with the listeners.
So my leadership essentials. So the stuff that I pride myself on is, first and foremost, it would be integrity. So doing what I say, basically. I think people see through the cracks in people when you don't follow through with what you say you're going to do. That's one of the things I've seen over my time as a professional, especially in certain coaches, when they say they're going to do something and they don't. That's the quickest way to lose respect and lose a team. And once you've lost that respect and lost your team, your days are numbered. I've seen, as I said, I've had a fair few coaches in my time as a professional. And yeah, as soon as they start going back on the word or saying, if you don't do this, you're not playing, and then this person plays, that's when stuff starts to go wrong and that's when you lose the respect to the group. So yeah, integrity is a big one for me. Honesty. I've always found if you're honest with people, good or bad news, they respect it. Pretty much, I think, yeah, being honest to someone's face, telling someone how it is, being brave enough to confront a situation, or if you've got an agreement or you want to give someone some feedback, tell them, be straight, have a conversation. More times than not, talking through something, you resolve any kind of issue that you can have, really. So yeah, integrity, honesty. And my last one, I think I stated it earlier in the piece, I'd say empathy, I think, is a big one. Getting to know people's situation, being able to empathise with people's situations, the whys, how they work. I think it's a really big one, empathy. I think a lot of people don't have it and they can't understand why someone's feeling a certain way. I think having that, I think it's a really, really, really big dynamic in leadership, and it helps you address people in a certain way that you know they're going to react well to, if you can understand where they're coming from, what they're feeling, and the way they work. So yeah, I'd say integrity, honesty, and empathy are the main keys.
They are very values driven, aren't they? And I think the other thing that really stands out for me is you probably underpin all of those with this really, really complex, if you like, goal setting regime of always having something to aim for and keep you motivated
constantly. Yeah, constantly. I've constantly got to have those goals and then tick them off. Right, what's next? That's it. I have a thing in a game that I say constantly throughout the game, and that's next job. Pretty much whatever good or bad happens in the game, it's a good way to get the boys to refocus really quick. Don't sort of say you drop a ball, forget about it, next job, right, what have we got to do next? And straight away, within a few seconds, you refocused, you're back in the game. Next job, what have I got to do next? What am I moving to? And that's the way I like to live my life, really. Next job, right, what have we got to do now?
Yeah, I think that's really strong, that, because with the next job, you've always got somewhere to go. 100%. You've got something that you can achieve. If everybody's just getting a bollock in for dropping the ball and what have you all the time, there's nothing you can do with that. But I really like that approach. Fantastic.
And just one final question. If somebody thinks they're already quite an inclusive leader, but we know they can always be better, what would be your tips for somebody really wanting to kind of go to that next job level?
Get to know people, pretty much. As I said, empathy being one of my things. Obviously, as you said, you don't know, you've not lived it, you've not been in the other person's shoes. If you can't live in their shoes, you've got to be able to empathize, and the only way to learn how to empathize is to communicate and get to know your that individual, get to know them on a deeper level, get to know their background, where they come from, why they do what they do, why they believe what they believe. And I think that's the only way to learn and educate yourself on on people from different backgrounds, and that'll help you get a better understanding. One thing I found off the back of the interviews I did last summer, which was there was just a mass of confusion and lack of understanding of the whole situation and what was going on, and that's what led to most of the backlash. Because when people don't understand something, they get defensive and they bar up and they don't like it and they want to push it away and they don't want to embrace it and they don't want it to happen, and that's what I found off the back of last summer, definitely. But I think the more people get to know, the more open they are to educate themselves and be willing to learn about new things and other people and how things work, I think it works really well.
Yeah, that's a lovely place to end, actually. It's one of them, summarising one of your favourite statements, John. Well, ask more questions and make less statements. Yeah. And if we could all do that, we'd all understand a bit more, wouldn't we?
100%, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure today. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for doing it later on in the evening. And I've learned a lot from that. So it's been a real delight. Thank you.
No worries at all. Thank you for having me.
Been really good, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you've got a lot out of this. If you'd like to read up a bit more on any of the content that you've heard in today's podcast, be sure to check out our website, scaffoldcoaching.com.